Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts State Police revise policy and say they will allow troopers to detain immigrants for federal officials. Also today from Common Health, new guidelines for daily low-dose aspirin regimens.
Millions of people take aspirin without ever discussing it with a healthcare provider.
Plus, we look at a federal appeals court ruling that says police do not need a warrant to get data about cell phone locations.
When you're looking for an armed, dangerous individual who is clearly a threat to others, every second, every hour counts.
And a Boston University professor who consulted on the remake of Roots.
You are Kunta Kinte, son of a moron, Binta Kinte. Your name is your spirit. Your name is your shield.
All that just ahead on Radio Boston, after this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We begin today with a controversial policy change from the Baker administration. Starting today, Massachusetts State Police will be allowed to detain undocumented immigrants for federal immigration authorities if that person has been convicted of a crime. It's a reversal of a policy from former Governor Deval Patrick, which said that police could not ask about immigration status unless it was tied to a criminal investigation. Governor Baker issued a statement saying that this change gives, quote, our statewide policing agency the tools necessary to detain criminals. But opponents say the move could undermine local police community relations and could result in people being detained even if they have no criminal conviction. Well, joining us to talk about this is Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also, Laura Rodolo, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
And we want to ask our listeners as well, what do you think of this change in policy? Is Governor Baker correct in reversing the Patrick administration policy and allowing police to detain undocumented immigrants at the request of federal officials? Do you think that this will improve public safety, or could it result in people being detained even if they are not criminally charged? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Sheriff Hodgson, I'd like to start with you. How is this change is rather complicated. So briefly, how do you explain how this policy is now different from what it was before?
Well, before, they were not allowing the state police, when the federal authorities wanted somebody held, the governor was ordering them not to abide by the request of the federal government, which makes absolutely no sense. Hmm.
Laura, what do you say to that?
It does make sense. In fact, 350 communities plus around the country and seven cities in Massachusetts do just that. They've limited their voluntary collaboration with immigration enforcement because they have found that as soon as you blur that line between local policing and immigration enforcement, people stop coming forward, they stop trusting their police and reporting crime, and that's just bad for everyone.
Well, that's absolutely not true. The notion, and this is the big red herring that's always thrown out there, that somehow the illegals won't come forward and report crimes. Look, the reality is human nature is such that if I were an American citizen to rob the bank and 3 weeks later somebody broke into my house, you can bet I'm not going to the police to tell them that somebody broke into my house for fear that I might get caught. These people, look, the idea, this is a red herring to try to allow illegals to stay in communities. But here's the problem. Anybody that was down at Ground Zero, and I was down there for 5 weeks with my staff, the one thing that everybody walked away that was on that rescue effort from Ground Zero
in New York,
the fundamental lesson that we learned was that we didn't need less cooperation with law enforcement. In other words, isolating, you know, ICE has somebody they believe is wanted, so we're not going to cooperate. What we learned was we needed to do more intelligence sharing so that we don't have these individuals in our neighborhoods, weaving themselves into the fabric of our society, who frankly don't belong there because they violated the law to get there to begin with. So,
Sheriff, I just want to bring something up real quick. I understand what your point is, but this has been an issue before. A lot of folks have heard some of this before. In 2014, Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone signed an executive order ending his city's participation in what was then the Secure Communities Program, which is somewhat similar to this. And the part in question that Curtatone was concerned about was a provision that allowed police to hold arrested immigrants for up to 48 hours based only on immigration violations. Let's listen to what Joe Curtatone said at a press conference in May of 2014.
What it does, it engenders fear in the immigrant community. It pushes people into the background and into the shadows. It discourages witnesses and even victims from cooperating with police.
So that's Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone 2 years ago saying that this actually could have an adverse effect on public safety. I'm wondering what you say about that, Sheriff.
Well, first of all, I think everybody knows that that mayor is also declared a sanctuary city. And frankly, he's in direct violation of federal law. And so when you have an elected official who is suggesting that we need to harbor people in violation of Title 8 of the U.S. Code, you have somebody that took an oath to uphold the Constitution and uphold our laws who is now directly violating those laws to protect a certain class of people. And that's the reality of all this. And the idea that somehow it's a good thing to allow these people to go off into the sunset only puts the American citizens and legal residents at more risk that these individuals, not all, but a number of them, will commit more crimes against innocent people who otherwise never would have been victims if we had just obeyed our laws and enforced our laws.
Now, Laura Rotolo, I'd like you to respond to some of the concerns that we've heard from the sheriff and why this policy is changing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm not a judge, but I can say that no judge, no court of law has found that Mayor Curtatone or any of the 350 cities and towns around the country or the seven cities in Massachusetts that have done something similar have been in violation of any federal law are harboring any person committing a crime. That simply has not happened because they are within their legal rights to do what they're doing, which is to just limit their voluntary collaboration with immigration. And I think just to tone down the rhetoric a little bit, this isn't really about terrorism. We don't know of a single case of a terrorist being deported under any of these programs. Federal immigration enforcement needs to remain the ambit of the federal government. And when it doesn't, we see the problems that happen in public safety.
So your main concern about this is that you feel that this is a federal, not a state police responsibility, Laura, is that right?
That's correct. And you don't have to take my word for it. You could take the word of the Boston City Council, for example, which a year ago also passed what's called the Boston Trust Act, which does the opposite of what the governor has just signed. It limits voluntary collaboration in order to gain the trust of immigrant communities. And I think the sheriff is in a different position from police who are patrolling the streets. Just by nature of the way sheriffs work in Massachusetts, they run the Houses of Correction. I think, you know, Sheriff Hodgson himself will tell you how much money he gets every year for holding immigration detainees. He's in a very different position. He's not out there having to get the trust of the community, which is what police are doing every day, and which is why they're passing things like the Trust Act around the state and around the country.
Well, if you follow that, your line of reasoning, I think you would find that it's really not reasonable, because the truth of the matter is, no, you're saying no judge said anything about the mayor violating federal law. No judge has said that in Colorado they're in violation of federal law either for legalizing marijuana. So that's not the question. The laws are on the books and they're there. And the only way that they should be changed, I mean, should be treated differently and enforced differently, is if they're changed by legislation. Now, the other thing you said was that this whole issue about federal agencies should work with federal agencies. Then so DEA should not work with local law enforcement in getting these cartels and drug dealers out of our neighborhoods.
I'm wondering, though, Sheriff, do you think, I think that much of the original argument as well was that it may be too broad. There may have been too much power on the part of law enforcement in general to be able to round people up, if you will, for lack of a better term. I think the statistics showed that ICE had placed more than 5,000 detainers on Massachusetts residents between 2008 and 2009. 2011, in a three-year period, we're talking 5,000 people, and 75% of those people had no criminal record and were sent to jail. So there were concerns about the authority here and what was happening. How do you tell people and assure people that there would not be an overreach on the part of authorities here if this policy is allowed?
Well, first of all, the ICE has made it very clear who they will and who they will not put into the process for deportation. The secure communities, Janet Napolitano in a speech at American University said, and this is when Deval Patrick was trying to fight secure communities, she came out in the Boston Herald and I think the Globe and said that the secure communities program was absolutely the best program for targeting criminal illegal aliens, and anyone who attempts to try to prevent secure communities from happening because they believe it's going to stop capturing everybody in the net, that is people who maybe aren't criminal illegal aliens, are actually promoting that very thing that they're trying to prevent by not supporting secure communities. So look, this whole thing about who we target and so forth, I think that probably the same people who are against ICE and law enforcement working together would probably have argued for people like Muhammad Atta and these other people who simply, and by simply saying, hey, listen, leave them alone. They're just down at a flight school trying to learn how to be pilots. Mm-hmm. These are the same people. Yeah, they haven't committed a crime yet, but you know what? They're down at a flight school in Florida, and they drove planes into the World Trade Center killing 3,000 people.
Yeah, but so we didn't catch them. And
we didn't catch them. But
and we had secure communities or something similar at that point. So I want specific examples of why law enforcement needs this to do its job. I mean, there are lawmakers holding a press conference at this hour, at this moment, and they're saying that Governor Baker is only doing this as a political move. They say that he probably feels that he may have angered conservatives because of his support for transgender legislation. So this is something to get conservatives on his side. And it's really not all that necessary. I mean, why is it necessary? Why do you need? Has there been a specific case where you can say that public safety has been improved because police had this authority?
Oh, sure. I mean, I could tell you exactly where it wasn't. Most recently, with Catherine Steinle, that's a perfect example of exactly why we don't want people released that ICE wants held. That's the most recent case, and how tragic was that? That the girl died in her father's arms while they were out to lunch, and the father asking her father, can you help me? And the last thing her father, last act he has is telling his daughter, I can't do anything for you while you're dying in my arms. So these are real cases that are happening all over the country. I don't know if you all are aware of this, but 95% of the warrants for murder in Los Angeles are for illegals, outstanding warrants. 75% of LA's most wanted are illegals, 75%. So We know that we need to be able, when ICE calls us and says, hey, we have we want you to hold that person, they're not going to just hold them because of their immigration status. They have their own criteria now that basically they have to meet certain levels, and that's what the PEP program does. These supervisors, if an ICE agent now brings somebody forward to be deported or put into deportation hearings, they have to go to a supervisor now and ask the supervisor whether or not it's okay to put these people into the proceedings. And these aren't people that are just here on overstays or administrative violations. And I would tell you, a couple of the agents that work with us here, they told me that they know of 10 outstanding felony warrants right now in their files in Rhode Island, and they're told by their higher-ups that these are guys who were criminal illegal aliens, deported, have come back in, which is a felony, and they have warrants for their arrest. They know where these guys are in the general vicinity where they are, and they're told by their authorities that they cannot go get them until such time as they commit another crime. Well, we don't need any more Catherine Steinle's at the hands of people like this. We need laws where ICE can work.
Well, if it's already a crime for them to have returned after they were deported, why can't ICE go and get them on immigration violations?
Well, because this is the new standard. This is the new standard that, well, you know, with the PEP program, they have to meet certain, they should be able to, and the ICE agents want to do it, but they're being told by this, there's a lot of things that the public are not aware of that's happened with this administration, in regards to protecting these illegals.
Well, we're going to let Laura respond in a second, and also we want to get some listeners in on the conversation here because we're rapidly running out of time, and our phone lines are lighting up. We want to remind listeners that if you'd like to comment or if you have a question for either of our guests, you can call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Julie is calling from Quincy. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. So my comment is simply this. Look, I'm an attorney in Massachusetts, and there are so many different ways that we already create a disenfranchised population out of the immigrant body to the point where they're not willing to report things that they otherwise would report because we make it impossible to actually do anything without putting your name down or your social. And I feel as though Charlie Baker has taken on this ancillary objective, which is absolutely going to undo everything that Deval has worked so hard really to instill in that population to make them feel like they belong in our community. And the guy should be worried about the trial court budget. He should be less concerned about undoing things that work and more concerned about the things that don't work and working on how he can fix those things.
All right, Julie, thanks very much for your call. I also want to hear from Mo, who's calling from Lowell. Mo, you're on the air.
Yeah, my name is Mo. I'm calling from Lowell. I work for the Department of VA. And my example is sometimes we are afraid we don't want to talk to the police. But now with this type of law, we won't want even the police to go close to us, to our friends, to our houses. Some of us are U.S. citizens. So with this type of law, we don't want our friends, family members, or anybody that is illegal to be arrested. So even if there is a crime, we will not call the police because we're afraid that when we call the police, we're going to go draw the book. Rope from the bush. Somebody will be arrested. Somebody will be deported.
Okay. Mo, thanks very much for your call. Sheriff Hodgson, how do you deal with that? How do you make sure that you are not creating fear among the immigrant community where they will maybe not help law enforcement solve crimes and be so fearful about being deported that this could actually backfire?
Well, look, we have people, American citizens, who for years have not come forward to be witnesses because of our criminal justice system. Look, we can't start marginalizing our laws and creating certain classes of people that don't follow the law and saying, look, because they won't report crimes or they won't do something else that we want them to do because they know they're here illegally and they could get in trouble for it and face a consequence is not a reason to say, well, therefore, we shouldn't have the law and it shouldn't apply. The reality is, let's start with the baseline. These people don't belong here. They came here illegally. They violated our laws. We have other people. We have 5 million people around the world right now waiting behind their borders, respecting the laws of the United States, waiting to pay the money, waiting to do it the right way through the application process. My father was an immigrant from England and raised 13 children here. And I would hope my father would never come here illegally, sneak in, and that would be the first thing that he did as an act as my father to bring children into the world. Mm-hmm. The reality is we have rules and laws to protect our democracy. And the idea of watering them down because some people are afraid of consequences because they violated laws, that's why you have consequences.
Okay, I want to give Laura a chance to respond. Laura, what do you say to that?
So, again, to tone down some of the rhetoric, I want to make sure that everyone who's listening today understands that this order is limited only to the state police. It doesn't affect any local police department. So if your city or town tells you, you know, that they're not going to be enforcing immigration laws, you can still believe that because this only affects state troopers, essentially. It's very limited. But it does send a very important message, and I think this issue of backfiring is important. The issue that we're talking about here is called an ICE detainer. It's a request from the federal government to hold somebody on their behalf for immigration charges. And we've seen that these detainers have been the subject of litigation around the country, and they're not just used against criminals, as the government might have you believe. The statistics themselves say that more than half of the people who are subject to these detainers have never committed a crime, have never been convicted of a crime, have no priors. And in fact, they're subject to mistakes. So a woman named Ada Morales in Rhode Island, who was a U.S. citizen, naturalized citizen, was detained not just once, but twice on an immigration detainer. And the second time she was detained, the immigration officer told her, we can't promise you it's not going to happen again. Our systems may just not catch up with your status. So we have U.S. citizens around the country being deprived of their liberty under these detainers. We have people who have real a real avenue to staying in the country who may have crossed illegally but may be eligible to get asylum being detained under these detainers, and communities suffering, not just because these detainers lead to deportation, but again, because they lead to more distrust in local police.
But what about the sheriff's contention that then we're allowing folks who are doing illegal things or criminal activity to continue to do them, and we're essentially protecting them?
So these policies don't protect anyone who is committing a crime. It does not affect the ICE's power. The federal government still can deport the people that it can deport. All this says is that local police shouldn't be collaborating with that, shouldn't be using their own resources, shouldn't be putting their own officers on the line, shouldn't be opening themselves up to liability when something goes wrong. But this is the role of the federal government, and they do it well. We've seen under the Obama administration record numbers of deportation, more than any other president in U.S. history. So deportations are still happening, and we, you know...
Well, that's not true. That's actually
sort of
not true.
Priority.
That's actually not true. What the Obama administration did was... The way they fudged the numbers by saying that when somebody's caught at the border, they used to be called under the Bush administration a turnaway. They were turned right around and sent back in. What the Obama administration did was they counted every one of those as deportations. So they just changed the numbers around to make it appear that they are deporting more. Let me tell you.
I'm sorry, but I can't agree with that statement. That's actually not true.
Well, it is true. And I've been down on the border. I've been down on the border on three different occasions. I can tell you the surge right now is as bad as it's ever been. We're bringing children into this country, exposing them. They're being raped along the way. The mothers are getting...
Okay, yeah, I really want to make sure we get some listeners into this conversation,
sorry.
Which is the intent. Jamie is calling from Malden. Jamie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I am a practicing immigration lawyer in Malden. I wanted to piggyback on Laura's excellent remarks that this is not a situation where criminals are being convicted in our state courts, serving their time, and then we're ignoring the detainers. This is now about the state police finding the power they used to have for pulling over a car for going 56 and 55, realizing there's adverse immigration history, and then being able to take a person to custody for immigration's behalf, on ICE's behalf. So the question is, do we really want the police to have that kind of power over our neighbors in our society?
But is the police officer that's pulling them over,
the
when you say...
Let's let Jamie finish.
Oh, I thought he was done. I'm sorry.
Sure. We can ask our neighbors in Massachusetts and immigrant communities. They remember 2012, 2013 of their friends and neighbors getting sucked into the immigration catch basin by minor traffic violations. That was the target of Governor Deval Patrick's change, and now we're moving away from that very positive change.
Okay, Jamie, we are just about running out of time. Sheriff, I'd like you to respond.
Well,
briefly, because we're almost out of time.
Sure. First of all, we do want to have state police to have that authority, because if they pull somebody over and they do have a immigration history of having committed a crime, they should be picked up and they should be held for if immigration customs enforcement wants some help. We're here to protect the citizens of our country. And if we have people who are here illegally who put themselves in these situations, we ought not to jeopardize the safety of the community simply because people want to come here illegally and be excused and treated as a different class of people.
Mm. Laura, I'm going to give you about 10 seconds to respond.
Thank you. Well, this is a very unfortunate move, and I think it's a step backwards, not just for immigrants, but for public safety. But I would urge people to understand that it is just limited to the state police, and that cities and towns who are considering different avenues of dealing with immigration and immigrants in their towns realize that this does not bind them.
All right. I'm sorry we have to end the conversation. I'm sure we'll talk about it again. Laura Rotolo is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson was with us as well. And thanks to all the listeners, and sorry for those who are still waiting on the phone, but we are out of time. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. Coming up, maybe a baby aspirin a day isn't so good for you after all. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, there's renewed debate about the information that law enforcement can get from cell phones. A federal appeals court ruled this week that police are permitted to get a cell phone's location data without a warrant. To better understand this ruling, we turn to Boston Globe technology reporter Hiawatha Bray. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi. So can you explain, what does this ruling do exactly? It allows people to figure out where cell phones are calling from for a pretty extended period of time. Is that right?
Well, pretty much. I mean, basically what happened is that back in 2011, some people who had been arrested for involvement in armed robberies were traced in part by information that had been collected like over the better part of a year from the phone company. I mean, they didn't collect the information over the better part of the year. The phone company did. The government went and got the information, including basically minute-by-minute information about where these people were based on their cell phone data. And the argument was that that was something that they should not have been able to get from the company without a formal warrant. And the court held basically the lower court held that was right, that this was an unreasonable search. But an appeals court, the full appeals court, by a 12-3 vote, sided with the government and said, yes, this is kind of information that they can get without having to get a search warrant because of an old-standing third-party doctrine, as it is called. The information about where you are when you're using your phone is information you have voluntarily shared with the phone company, and therefore, the government can go to this third party and get the information without violating your Fourth Amendment rights. That's the argument, and it's based on a long string of legal precedents. But the counter-argument is, cell phones are different, because of the fact that they can trace you moment by moment in a way that didn't exist back when this original precedent was set. I mean, it was set for basic information that the phone company had back in the 1970s when people didn't have cell phones. And a phone didn't have this incredibly granular, precise information, or your phone records, rather, didn't have this incredibly precise, granular information about every move you made. And the argument was, this is different. We need a different standard. But the court said, nope, sorry, we're keeping the old standard.
Even though we're talking about an unlimited amount of time, is that right? I mean, cell phone records
for as
long
as you...
Well,
I don't know if they set
Okay, go ahead.
It seems to imply that. I'm not sure that they have said formally it's an unlimited amount of time, but the implication seems to be that as long as the cell phone company keeps this data, they can go get it, and they can use it, as you say, maybe you mean unlimited in this sense. They can look at your movements not just for one day or a week or whatever, but they can get your location data. In this case, I believe it was 221 days worth of location data, which happened to be in the phone company records. And that's what has people a little nervous. It certainly has me nervous, because what you've created is the prospect of this sort of retroactive surveillance, precisely because when you're carrying your phone, that kind of data is being stored constantly by the phone company, which has to store it. This isn't like 1984 where they're doing it to spy on you. Cell phone, in order for cell phones to work, they have to know where you are. So they have to have that data, or the system doesn't work. The government goes, and now say they want to know what you were doing a year ago, they can do a sort of retroactive surveillance without having to have followed you a year ago, because the phone company was following you a year ago, so they get the information from them. And that's kind of creepy.
Right. So we've heard this debate about this third-party doctrine in the past when there have been privacy issues about technology. Do you think that, or why doesn't somebody take steps to update it?
I don't know whether there is going to be some move in, for example, Congress to do it. I think that's the kind of thing you're going to have to do. If, as a lot of people suspect, the Supreme Court does not take this case up, then we're either going to have to learn to live with this, or there's going to have to be a change in the law. And I mean, there are some reasons to think that there might be some need for that, because there are other cases like the case of U.S. versus Jones, where there was this issue of whether you needed a warrant to put a GPS tracker on somebody's car, and the court said, no, you definitely need a warrant. But some of the justices seem to want to go even further and say that any kind of location data derived from a person's movement is so granular and so precise that you should have to have a warrant to get all kinds of things like that. And it was Justice Alito, I believe, who wrote that he thought that there should really be a new standard that says, with this kind of stuff, with your phone being able to track your every move, that's a new kind of issue. And maybe we need a new kind of approach that says, anytime it's that granular, that precise, you should have to get a warrant. And if you read the dissents in this case, 3 of the 15 judges, it doesn't sound like a lot, but at least 3 of them, as did the previous appeals court, all said, wait a minute, we're not sure this is a good idea. people who sign up for cell phone service did not know consciously that they were giving up this much information that could be. I mean, you say, well, you're voluntarily sharing some information. Does the average cell phone user know that he's sharing, for all practical purposes, the right to follow every move you make for the rest of your life? And not only that, some of the data is derived from calls coming to your phone so that you didn't even voluntarily engage in the phone call. They can track your data, your movements, based on incoming calls. So you didn't consent to that, but according to the court, they can use that.
But, you know, law enforcement will probably say, hey, this is a tool that could, you know, more quickly solve criminal investigations. And people do agree when they are using cell phones that they are going to be tracked. That's part of the game. So why shouldn't we have access to that? Because maybe it will improve public safety.
Well, I don't think anybody's saying they shouldn't have access to it. I think there should be a higher standard for getting access. The idea that you should have to go to a judge, show probable cause to believe that these people are engaged in some kind of criminal activity, and get a warrant. The issue is not should they not be able to get access
at all.
Of course they should, under the right circumstances.
But it can be time-consuming and cumbersome to get warrants, which is
why. Oh, I know. Isn't that terrible? Yeah, it's easier to just kick people's... Let's just kick people's doors in randomly. And I'm not saying cops think that way. I'm just saying that you have to have safeguards. And I want to be fair. The logic of the majority ruling in the court seems to me not totally out of line. They're basically saying we want to stick to a standard that has existed in this question for a long time. They're not breaking new ground here. They're refusing to break new ground. And maybe they have a point. But I think somebody ought to break new ground in the form of a law that says, no, you need a warrant to get that kind of precise information about people. Otherwise, the government can, in effect, follow us around years later. After we've done something, or after they think we've done something, they can go back and, in effect, do surveillance on what we were doing 2 years ago, following us moment by moment. I don't think that's something we should just casually allow.
Is there something consumers can do to protect location data?
Yeah, turn off your cell phone. I mean, basically, seriously, there's the location data that, like, Google or Apple collects through those location settings on your phone, so you could turn that off. But if you want to use the phone, I'm sorry. The only thing you could do is maybe get a burner phone, like they do in the movies, where nobody knows who it is that owns the phone. But as long as your name is attached to that account and you've got the phone switched on, the phone company has to track your location or the system won't work. So, sorry.
All right.
Don't commit crime.
There you go. Hiawatha Bray is a technology reporter for the Boston Globe and author of You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and thanks for the plug.
Let's turn now to our weekly Common Health segment with Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Deb.
So today we're going to talk about baby aspirin and whether you should take it to protect your heart. Many of us have probably heard commercials like this one.
My husband had a heart attack last year. His doctor told him he should be taking Bayer. He is now.
Taken regularly, Bayer low dose helps prevent 1 out of 3 heart attacks.
Just 6 years ago, doctors recommended baby aspirin to prevent heart attacks and strokes in most older people, but now those recommendations are changing, and many doctors are questioning whether taking a daily baby aspirin is really worth the risks. Can you explain this a bit more, Carrie?
Yeah, sure I can, Deb. And the recommendations are narrowing a bit. So we have a big post up now on Common Health by Dr. Elizabeth Poorman. She's a resident physician at Cambridge Health Alliance, and the headline will tell you a lot. It's popping a daily baby aspirin? Caution, new guidelines amid controversy. Mm-hmm. So you can hear that things are not quite so simple anymore as, you know, before we were hearing, if you're middle-aged or above, you probably want to take a baby aspirin as part of your daily routine. Now there seems to be quite a bit of debate around this.
So what exactly is changing?
Okay, so there are new recommendations out from what's called the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They're a top national panel that issues guidelines on a lot of tricky medical topics like cancer screening. There's often some controversy around them. So before, this task force had endorsed aspirin for this huge swath of the population, like most men ages 45 to 79, women 55 to 79, who aren't at high risk for bleeding or other possible aspirin side effects. So all told, it was like a quarter of the population that were thought to benefit from aspirin.
And now how have they narrowed?
Okay, so now they're recommending aspirin, and we're talking about baby aspirin, by the way, daily baby aspirin. They're recommending it mainly for people between 50 and 60 years old with high risks of heart disease and no history of serious bleeds. And the task force says people between 60 and 70 should have a longer conversation with their doctor because their risk of bleeding because of their age is higher.
So why have so many patients then been on these aspirin regimens for so long?
Well, as you heard in that advertisement, if you've had a heart attack or a stroke, there's actually very good evidence that aspirin is going to help you prevent a second one. So the disagreement is over people who haven't had a heart event and whether they should be taking aspirin. Now, Dr. Joanne Manson at Brigham and Women's Hospital, for example, she's a very prominent researcher. She says that patients who may not have had a heart attack, but they have risk factors like smoking or high blood pressure, that they should ask a doctor about taking a baby aspirin a day.
And Carrie, remind us, why does aspirin help if someone has a heart event?
So the simple answer is that it thins your blood and it prevents clots. And researchers have known that very well for a long time, that in fact, daily baby aspirin does lower the risk of heart attacks and strokes. And because heart disease is the leading cause of death, it's sort of up there neck and neck with cancer, it made a lot of sense for doctors to recommend aspirin to a lot of people over 50. And by the way, Deb, it's looking like there's another benefit, which is that a few large studies have found that people who take daily aspirin for at least 5 years see slightly lower rates of cancer, especially colon cancer. So here's Dr. Andrew Chan. He's a gastroenterologist at Mass General Hospital. And a study he co-authored this year found that aspirin could prevent nearly 1 in 50 cancers.
The potential reduction in absolute cancer rates for a general population are really quite significant. And when you think about the fact that many parts of the world, you know, screening is not available in a widespread way, to have an inexpensive way to prevent such a lethal cancer like colorectal cancer is really a major step forward.
So that's pretty appealing too, right? Prevent cancer. And Dev, I have to confess, I started popping baby aspirin myself a few years ago after I spoke with a leading cancer researcher and he said he was taking it to prevent cancer.
So then, okay, I'm confused, Carrie. Why are we saying fewer people should be taking baby aspirin? Then?
Right, if it's so great, right? Why should fewer people take it? So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is saying fewer people should take it because there are serious risks associated with taking aspirin. Here's Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo. She's the chair of that task force, explaining the harms and benefits of aspirin and why the recommendation has changed.
We're among the first groups, I think, to really try to integrate the two types of benefits for heart attack and stroke prevention, as well as for preventing colorectal cancer, as well as the newest evidence on harms, most commonly bleeding from your GI tract, but also rarely but more seriously, the harms that are associated with hemorrhagic stroke.
So hemorrhagic stroke, a bleeding stroke, that can be very serious. Because aspirin thins the blood, it can also cause bleeding, especially in the stomach and the brain. And that bleeding in the brain is something you do not want. And new technology has allowed us to identify more brain bleeds, and therefore we're seeing more potential harms of aspirin. So basically what you're seeing is like the kind of flip-flop that, of course, can absolutely drive us all crazy, right?
What like, do we
just
do next?
Right, just tell me what to do. Just make up your mind. You told me to take aspirin, and now you're telling me not to. But I would argue that this is actually progress, that the recommendations are being adjusted to new data. They're being refined, and that's actually how it's supposed to work.
Essentially, right? A question of weighing potential benefits against potential risks.
Right, which we have to do with anything we put in our bodies, right? And the risks are complicated, the benefits are complicated, and they're very individual, which is why this is the kind of decision that you really want to make in consultation with your doctor. And that's the central point that Dr. Elizabeth Poorman makes in her Common Health piece, Talk to Your Doctor. Now, some people may have been told in the past to take aspirin in order to stay healthy, but the new data means that even if your doctor told you that in the past, it's time to revisit the question. And most of all, it's not a decision you should be making on your own. And I think in the past, a lot of us, including me, just did kind of put ourselves on baby aspirin because we heard it was a good idea, right? Not because we heard it from our doctors.
So, are you still taking it?
So, actually, no, Deb. I stopped taking it a while ago because of some of the studies that crossed my desk. But frankly, now I'm just confused, probably like a lot of patients. And I definitely need to talk about it at my next checkup because my default tends to be I never take a pill unless I have to. And that's probably the main reason that I stopped.
And then that's probably part of the point too, right? Baby aspirin is medication, even if it's a cute little pill that you can get over the counter.
Right. Don't let the over-the-counter fool you. And Dr. Alyssa Poorman writes that it can be hard to communicate the serious potential risks to patients.
Also, millions of people take aspirin without ever discussing it with a healthcare provider. It's hard for us as physicians to reach those people.
So even though it is over-the-counter, it's like serious juju.
Okay, bottom line, taking baby aspirin is a complicated decision and one that patients should not make on their own. Talk to your doctor.
Okay, I will, Deb, I will.
All right, Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health. Did I do my best mom?
Yes, strict voice
there? Okay, she's the editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
For a link to Dr. Elizabeth Borman's piece on aspirin, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it was almost 40 years ago that the television series Roots became a legend.
You must hear your name first. You are Kunta Kinte, son of Moran Binta Kinte, grandson of Kairaba Kunta Kinte and Yaisa. You must always honor your ancestors. The ones who love you and watch over you. Your name is your spirit. Your name is your shield.
Roots is the story of a man named Kunta Kinte who was sold into slavery from his village in West Africa and brought to America. The update of Roots, which premiered on Memorial Day and finishes tonight, brings the story of Kunta Kinte's family to new audiences, and it's said to be technically improved and more historically accurate. Our next guest will talk about that with us. John Thornton is director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University, and he worked as an advisor for the new Roots miniseries. Professor, welcome.
Thanks.
So what was your role as an advisor for this new Roots?
Well, my field of study is African history. And so they asked me primarily to work on the first 30 minutes or so of the segment, which is on Africa. And that's pretty much what I did. I made a little bit of a contribution to some of the later parts, but basically it was confined to Africa.
And so were there some aspects of the original Roots that you had to work on and change to make them more historically accurate?
Well, we had to change quite a bit of the original Roots. I mean, the filmmakers were in a spot because they had to honor the basic outlines of the story. And at the same time, there was this all this visual evidence out there that people already knew about. And so they couldn't change everything, but they did change a lot, and they changed it in a very good way, in my opinion.
So tell me one big change.
Well, the biggest change was the transformation of Jufre from being a little country village to being
Jufre
pretty significant
is
town.
The native town where Kunta Kinte is from.
The town of Jufre was the town where Kunta Kinte was supposed to have originated, and the Kinte family continues to live in that town, so that was a good start. Today, and when Alex Haley visited in the 60s, it's not much of a place. It's a pretty small backcountry town. But in 1767, it was probably had 10,000 people, and next door to it was another town of equal size. So we're talking about a really sizable urban kind of a settlement, considering that Annapolis, where he was going, had 2,300 people at the same time. And Jufre was archaeologically investigated since the first Roots was made, so we know a lot more about its extent and how actually cosmopolitan it was, much more so than what we would have seen in the 77 version.
So it was a big, diverse sort of center.
Yes.
And do we have any more information now than we did then about what Kunta Kinte's family may have been like?
Well, we have more information now in the sense that there were people, of course, that knew a lot more about it at the time, back in the 70s. But the Kintes were a family that's a part of a group within the Mandinka culture called Jula. Julas were a commercial group. There were multiple families within the Jula tradition, and they could be from different ethnicities as well as Mandinka, although Mandinka was the common language that all the Julas did. The Jewelers specialized in commerce and in Islamic scholarship. That's what they were known for. Hmm. Either one or the other, or sometimes both, all combined. Kunta Kinte's idea of studying in Timbuktu was not something that would have been alien to the Jewelers, although I don't think his sort of sudden decision in the presentation, you have to study for a long time to get to that place, and you probably would have had to go to an intermediate school before you got to Timbuktu, but that's a small point.
Hmm. And so it was predominantly Muslim? Is that right?
Yes, it was, although it did contain a Catholic church. There was a Catholic community there that had been there since the 17th century. And there was, of course, a chapel for the English trading post, and there was a French church in Albreda, the town right next to it. So everybody else was Muslim.
So, you know, one of the things that's different about today's roots from the 1977 version is its depiction of African slave traders. And let's listen to this scene where Kunta Kinte's father is threatening a rival family for illegally selling slaves to the British. Let's listen.
The king knows you sail upriver to buy slaves at favorable prices. He knows you're trading them for English guns.
None of this is your business, Omoro Kinte.
We control who goes up and down the river.
So that part of the story, talk about what was going on there and the historical accuracy of that.
Well, this is an interesting section because Jufure was a part of a kingdom, and the king they're talking about is a man named Nandanko Sunta Sonko. He had become king in 1760. And a French witness of the time described him as I'm going to read to you now. He made an oath on his succession to the throne to never soil his hands with human blood, and he has never yet violated it at all. He was reputed to be not necessarily an enemy of the slave trade, but an enemy of the sort of disorderly conduct that often went along with the slave trade. And he was, for that reason, that sort of scene could have made sense. We're talking about a Jula family. I'm presuming that the other family besides the Kuntas, they're called the Kolos in the movie, that these people were basically violating a law that the king had placed on the illegal enslavement of people. It's important to realize that there was a legal process in African societies that at least in theory should be obeyed, although it was frequently violated in practice.
Hmm. And so there was a big difference about what slavery was in these communities and what we're talking about here.
Well, absolutely. Jewelers dealt in long-distance commerce. That was their specialty. And long-distance commerce meant gold trade, slave trade. So Kunta Kinte's family, whether he personally was involved in it, would have been involved in the slave trade. The difference between the two, if we take the movie at face value, is that the Kintes were following the rules as established by the king, who was anxious to prevent disorder, and the other family, the Kolos, which was violating the rules and were prepared to act violently.
I understand there's a connection between Gambia and Boston.
Well, there is, as a matter of fact. Research that Linda Haywood, who's my colleague at the African American Studies program, and I did a couple years ago, we looked at shipping patterns that brought slaves to New England. And in the 1750s and 60s, at the end of the Seven Years' War, a lot of slaves were brought in by New England shippers. And most of them came from Muslim parts of West Africa, including the Gambia. So probably Boston's most famous African resident, Phyllis Wheatley, might very well have come from Jufure. She was enslaved in Gambia, and she might have even known Kunta Kinte.
Wow. You know, why do you think this series is important? And I ask this because the backdrop is that there are some prominent African Americans, just recently Snoop Dogg says, you know, people should boycott this new update of Roots. He says he's tired of movies about slavery. Why aren't there movies about success? Does he have a point?
Well, he has a point for sure. I think we'd all like to see more movies about success. And I know I would certainly like to see more movies about historical topics that don't necessarily constantly deal with slavery. It is difficult to deal with this period of time and to deal with African-descended people in the Americas without wrestling with slavery. So we can either decide to excise a large chunk of American history or we have to deal with it.
Okay. John Thornton, director of the African American Studies Program at Boston University and an advisor on the new remake of Roots. The finale airs tonight on the History Channel. John, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.